This is Philosophy versus Improv, where two sages try to teach each other a thing or two, and maybe you, the audience, get something out of it as well. This is Mark Linsenmeyer bringing the philosophy to you today.
And this is Mary Hines bringing the improvisation, and we are joined today by...
Hey, this is Rich Baker. Nice to be here. Thanks for having me.
Has Mary explained to you anything about the show? Do you know what the format is?
Well, I listened to your episode with Vicky. Seems like you'll talk and then improvise and then talk and then improvise.
That's the way it works. And we post-talk then decide why the thing that we are talking about and the thing that we improvise into are really saying exactly the same thing, and they completely support each other and are a coherent educational entertainment project.
Like, for example, I just watched the movie Weapons. I knew it was going to be amazing, but I was waiting to be at a client's home that had a really nice flat screen and a really nice sound system. And so I had that with my last client. And the layers of storytelling and Weapons, oh my gosh, if you haven't seen it, you need to. And I'm not going to say anything else.
No spoilers.
But that's kind of like how we do philosophy versus improv. It's layers of storytelling without creepy children. Or sometimes with creepy children. Yeah, are you right? Shut up, Hines. Shut your mouth.
And what's your dealio in the improv scene? Rich, tell us about yourself a little bit.
Dealio, back to 1994, good times. I run an improv school called Dare to Fail Improv. It's an online school. I've been teaching and coaching improv over 20 years, and I started improvising in 1999, and I kind of figured out a way to make a little career out of it, even a space where it's not all that easy to kind of find paying gigs.
Well, failure. So in most people's presentations in philosophy, they don't want to fail because they want to show that they understand. They want to give accurate information. The philosophy that I've generally had on my podcasts, I read it. I made something out of it. I'm going to try to articulate it, but it's probably not going to be what your professor, who has read all the secondary literature and actually knows in detail about this, they've specialized. I have not specialized. I'm, you know, like the kindergarten teacher. I guess the kindergarten teacher is not only one night ahead of his students. I guess it's more the high school Spanish substitute teacher who's just like, I'll just learn the lesson the night before and teach it to you. But I find that articulating things wrongly, well, you get feedback, you figure out, you improve. It's not that dissimilar.
So the question I would to both of you gentlemen and to our musing audience, why is failure important?
So for me, failure is absolutely necessary to learn improv and pretty much anything. Like if you start juggling, you're not going to juggle very well at first, right? You're going to drop the balls over and over. But if you don't embrace that, like if you just judge yourself by, I'm going to juggle a couple balls, and if I fail, then I'm never going to do it again. You're never going to learn how to juggle, right? So it's a necessary part of the journey. And when people aren't okay with failure, they rob themselves of the ability to really learn something, trust it, and get something in their bones. And improv, you just have to fail over and over and over. I mean, I'm sure Mary can tell you many times she's failed. I can tell you many times I've failed. Any good improviser who can do good scene work is sitting on top of hundreds, thousands of scenes that didn't work because they were okay with failing.
I love words so much. And I just looked up failure. And the first definition offered is a lack of success. But then it's like, what is success? Because it is all success, right? If you like think about an analogy of climbing, if you miss your hand or your foothold, you're still succeeding by staying on the mountain and making progress up the mountain. You just need to find another place to get your footing.
I've actually been reading a lot of Freud this week for a couple different, for teaching and for my regular philosophy podcast. Is that, you know, we start out with these unattainable desires, and then out of self-defense, we withdraw. So you might, you know, very naturally, like, I want to put all my effort into love. But then that's very risky because the person could reject you. They could die. There's lots of things that could happen. So a common strategy is to, well, let me spread that out. Let me just, I love the world. I love everybody. You know, I'm going to just be in love with love itself and not have a contingent on, am I going to succeed in this thing? So I think the same thing, like, am I going to climb the mountain, or is it about my experience climbing the mountain? So I'm not saying this is like cowardly or, you know, this is just something that we do, that we retract our, I mean, yeah. Do you think that there's anything wrong with retracting your goals from something that is risky to something that you can definitely attain because you're your own judge?
I mean, it always depends on the situation, I'd say, but like whenever you're talking about failure, you always have to understand what are stakes. And in improv, the stakes are absolutely nothing. We're you know, if you're a surgeon, you don't want to fail while you're practicing. So surgeons have big stakes. And, you know, fighter pilots, there's all kinds of people that have tremendous stakes. They don't want to fail at their actual job. With the learning aspect, though, that's where you want to, that's where you have to be okay, like crashing the flight simulator in order to learn how to fly the real plane.
Hey, everybody. Welcome. I'm your server, Geraldine. Welcome to the Stakes as You Deserve Them house. If you want to take a look at the menu, you can tell me what kind of steak you're interested in. But ultimately, I'm going to bring you whatever steak size you deserve. How may I help you today?
I know, Marshall, you've been here before. What do you think? What kind of steak should
you eat? Oh, yeah, Marshall. I couldn't remember your name, but I could remember that dome anyways.
No. The name's not important. The thing is, you want to be in a state of acceptance for whatever she brings you. Don't have any expectations, you know?
Sure. So we actually start off the menu selection process with a small questionnaire. So, Marshall, can you remind me what you do for a living?
Yeah, I'm a skydiving instructor.
Oh, well, why don't you go ahead and go to page 3, which features a really lovely bacon wrap filet mignon.
Ooh.
Because you, my friend, you deserve a big steak.
No, geez, thanks.
I didn't catch your name. What's your friend's name? What's your name, sir? Don't be shy.
My name is Reginald T. Willington. I'm one of Marshall's students. I also run a big healthcare insurance company. You probably heard of us. We're Deny It All Insurance.
Oh, that's a tough one.
Yeah.
May I call you Reggie before I fillet you, if you will?
Of course.
Why don't you go to the back of the menu? There you'll find the tofu selection of it's tofu that's been in the present of meat breeze. Why don't you pick from there? Because you don't get big steaks. Maybe a bit for your skydiving bravery, but then once you say that you fuck over my fellow man, then you're getting tofu meat kissed.
I mean, Marshall, I thought you liked tofu, right? Or do you not like tofu?
Yeah, I'm a big fan. You get the tofu, we'll switch. We'll switch.
All right, that's a good idea. All right, so I'm going to order the...
I'm going to pretend I didn't eat it.
The thin gruel tofu. With just a little bit of gelatin on top, an unidentifiable gelatin, I believe it says.
Sure, just like the unidentifiable dread that we all feel on a daily basis. I'll get that right over to you.
I feel no such dread. I don't know what she's talking about.
And scene. I don't know, whenever I hear steaks, you know, it's like high stakes. Like, I think it's the comedian. It's just the clown in me. I got that clown in me. But I always think of steak. But I think of, like, the classic, like, image of a prime cut of steak. So thank you for indulging me. An omonym, if you will. And if you won't, I don't care.
That's true.
It's true. Don't give a fuck at all.
Are the stakes for improv altered? The fact that we're doing this and presenting it publicly to who knows how many, maybe you're applying for a job and the first thing they Google and they find, Rich Baker, you've done makeup for this many. Oh, then they scroll past that, find you. Oh, this is the Dare to Fail improv guy. And he was on this podcast and man, he stunk up the place. What was going on with that? And then you don't get the job.
Yeah, it was the meat sweats from the Meat As You Deserve It house. I can't remember the name of the diner. It's made up.
Yeah, I mean, I haven't applied for any kind of job in so long, I couldn't even tell you. But the unfortunate thing is that in our current 2025, going on 2026 world, that things you put on the internet can have real consequences, you know, and that kind of thing. So you do have to be careful in that kind of stuff. I would say that if a job is going to not hire someone because of a bad scene they did on an improv podcast, I think that job might be a little too picky for me.
You get to go to the dumpster in the back alley and fight raccoons, Robbie and Denise, for our meat scraps.
How much does that pay? Does the raccoon job pay?
It pays you in experience.
And exposure.
And exposure to deadly diseases.
Yeah. Excellent. Good. My agent says I need more exposure.
Yeah, go ahead. Check out Robbie and Denise. Don't get too close to their faces.
I feel like one of the tragedies of my artistic life was that my too main funny. Partner in my band, I was really, you know, set to be a musician in college, kind of came from a more economically conservative background. I didn't mind like taking a year off, trying stuff, but he was like, oh, I can't take a year off and like tour because it will look bad to employers in the future that I have a gap in my resume. That's he somehow got in his head that these engineering jobs that he would apply to would be like, I don't know if you're trustworthy. You just toured around with a rock group for a year. You can't do that. So it's not even like a current, it's a long-term worry.
It's amazing to me, the things that were programmed to have them make or break us, while they help us during the process, the journey, ultimately some things we get to drop. Like I was teaching a class the other day, and I always do a check-in with my students, see how everyone's feeling, how everyone's doing. And she was saying that she's in college, and she was saying that she was really nervous about this test tomorrow. And she doesn't really, it's a speech class, and she's worried about it because she has an accent and it's like holding her back. And I said, hey, from one A student, summa cum laude, honors graduate to you, it's okay to just get a B. Like, it's okay. You don't have to get an A. And then I saw everyone like nodding, and immediately I felt bad. I'm like telling this college student that you're like, you don't need to get an A and everything. But as long as you're learning, right? As long as you're keeping your GPA at a, even then, right? It's like, even as I'm saying it, it's like the stuff that we hold as so sacred, does it really matter?
Well, that's partly put into us because of the kind of fucked up system we're in, right? Like, school wasn't started to educate the masses. It was started to get the masses to where we could, you know, work in factories and be obedient factory workers and things like that. And it's still pretty much kind of the same way, even though we don't have factories anymore, which is ironic. But like, your friend who was an engineer in the band probably had a real fear, because there are engineering firms that are, you know, the little I know of engineers, like, they're very conservative, stuffy, like, I, you know, if this is out of place, the answer is no. And like, I would rather work for people who would be fascinated by the fact that I took a year off to tour with a band rather than would judge me for that.
Sure.
So obviously in the entertainment industry, success has, you know, I remember my father, just who was also a musician, a failed musician, and that in, he didn't end up doing it for a living. He did it, you know, in a bunch of clubs and coffee houses and things for a number of years, but eventually just like, all right, I gotta get a job. I'm gonna drive across the country interviewing at places, and I will stop wherever they give me a good job. And I always, you know, very defensively, like, the bands I like, I run a music podcast now, almost no band can support themselves now. Like, it's kind of nice.
Yeah, right.
They're like, they all have to run a studio or have some sort of day gig or just something else to hustle to, you know, patch together. I'm sure it's a lot like improv has it's nearly always been.
Yeah.
So yes, we modify our view of what counts as success, that just seemed like a very old fashioned, like, oh, unless you're on Carson, then you're not, you know, you haven't succeeded. Like, but yeah, you just want to make good art. Was Velvet Underground on Carson?
None of the comedians nowadays get on Carson, and they're all failures. Like, that's right. No one's even gotten on Carson in like the last 30 years.
I mean, I'm sure we'll get Robo Carson at some point. They'll be like, AI Carson.
If we've been good boys and girls, we'll get a Robo Carson. Rich is like, absolutely not. Return it. I don't want it.
I want a Robo Carson for Christmas. I want to be invited to the couch by my Robo Carson in the privacy of my own home.
Johnny, honey, did you write it on your letter to Santa, honey?
I did write it on my letter, but I don't think this is actually a real product yet. So does Santa have like an R&D team and can like develop this for me?
I don't know, honey.
Hello.
Oh, what would you look?
Did someone order a Robo Carson?
Honey, Merry Christmas.
Oh, do Carmack. Do the.
The answer is a little boy who got what he wanted for Christmas. It's you.
Oh, wow. It's like a Jeopardy version.
You're going to have to charge him every 8 hours. He needs to be plugged in, but you're going to need to plug him into the garage because I just don't enjoy the optics. I just watched Five Nights at Freddy's, and, you know, there's something about a resting animatronic that makes your mother very nervous. So you're just going to have to charge him in the garage, but put a sheet over him so he doesn't get damp.
I think to make it more relaxing, I've been, at least the design specs that I had sent to Santa, you can, instead of putting a sheet over, you take Carson's face off and see those mechanical things, you know, like in Terminator toward the end of, right before it gets crushed by the thing. And that's just much more relaxing. Would that, Mom, would that make you feel better?
Well, why don't we see it? Mr. Carson, RoboCop. Sir, would you please take your face off? Oh, my God.
Kind of sexy.
Honey, I'm worried about you.
I was reading in your expression. But maybe it is.
I would think this face reads more regret and dread and less arousal.
With the no face, with the electronic face, can you still do the Carmack or does that change it?
Kill, 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 oh. Kill, kill.
Okay. End scene. Yay. I had a feeling Rich could do channel some Johnny Carson.
That was very good.
Rich is really good at impressions.
Oh, thank you very much.
He's a stellar performer.
You're very kind. Right back at you.
A very flexy chameleon-like character actor. Yeah.
Is your middle name Little? Were you named after?
No. My dad, I think, named me after a personal friend. My mom wanted to name me Jason or Jeremy, but she had to have a C-section with me, so she was still under anesthesia when my dad filled out the birth certificate.
I think I knew that story, but that's sneaky.
Yeah, my dad was not always the most considerate person.
That's a little sneaky.
Hey, let's stop so I can tell you that this podcast is sponsored by Squarespace. It's an all-in-one website platform designed to help you stand out and succeed online. Squarespace gives you everything you need to claim your domain, showcase whatever it is you want to offer to the world with a professional website, and get paid for it. I remember back in the 90s, my first website, I built it through Netscape, and it looked terrible. Then I got some software for my computer that had more options, but I had to keep learning more and more things. And then when we started the Partially Examined Life site, we use publicly accessible framework, a lot of plugins. They always need updating. They conflict with each other. If I wasn't paying somebody to manage this for me, I just couldn't do it this way. Well, Squarespace eliminates all that, makes it super simple to start a website that looks absolutely beautiful. There are professionally designed, award-winning templates, and now you can even have AI build you a template right there in Squarespace. In just a few steps, it is grotesquely easy. The AI can even generate premium content for you, product descriptions, things like that. And here's another thing that I don't want to have to learn about. SEO, making your website appear right at the top of relevant search rankings. Well, and they have e-commerce, including managing and selling digital content or real physical things. It can manage complex international shipping issues. And Squarespace can accept donations. It can let you integrate videos very easily into your site. Cutting-edge visual effects and intuitive built-in analytics, so you can keep an eye on your website traffic, learn where to focus engagement, track your revenue. Head to squarespace.com/Linsenmayer, that's my last name, LinsenMayer, for a free trial. And when you're ready to launch, use offer code Linsenmayer to save 10% off your first purchase of a website or domain. So what do we feel about the, I've heard equally, rather than dare to fail, the, there's no wrong notes in jazz. You know, in improv, you say something inappropriate, somebody else just builds on it. And actually, it doesn't fail.
So there's a term that I came up with because I like big fancy words called retroactive alchemy, which is the idea of whatever you say, whether it's funny or not, if we treat it like it was gold after the fact, then it becomes gold, right? So the mistake becomes the game. Or Tina Fey's, there's no mistakes, there's only opportunities, stuff like that, right? So that's absolutely true. That said, improv used to, back in the bad old days, yes and was the only thing that mattered in improv. And so if someone brought up some horrible topic like rape or cancer or something like that, then we were just expected to yes and it. And now, thankfully, I don't hear about that hardly anymore. It's, we have boundaries, we have guardrails. Like, yes, you're supposed to yes and, but we're going to play within, you know, our own boundaries of decency, and every group's going to individually decide what that is, but I'd say on the whole, we don't just yes and anything anymore, which is very important.
There's probably a way to yes and anything, like rape. Oh, a four-letter word misspelling rope. Okay, I'm doing the crossword. Like, that's So now we're not talking about rape anymore. We've moved on to crosswords.
But Mark, that's a great example of how I teach yes and, is that the yes part is the acceptance. You must accept that that happened because your audience sees it, your fellow players see it, you see it, and we need to address it. So it's the yes is the acceptance, not necessarily continuing that, but yesing by agreeing and moving it forward. So Mark, I feel like that's a great example of like, you mean rope. Oh, it's actually, you know, exactly like you did.
Yeah. And if someone's not trying to push it, you can, but I mean, if someone's like, I want to do a scene about, you know, cancer, torture or something, like if they're going to do their thing. That's why like a teacher, coach, someone in authority has to be like, look, we're not doing that. It's not allowed kind of a thing. And give us those guardrails in the same way that, you know, anything, like you play sport, there's out of bounds and there's inbounds. And improv is very similar to a sport. And it's just, we're going to go, okay, what are the boundaries here? And if you're doing a midnight show on a Saturday and you're advertising it as the dirtiest show in Chicago, there was one called The Hot Carl for years that was great and it was super fun and it was a lot of, you know, rowdy crowd bringing beer and going nuts and they wanted that kind of stuff. So it's like that was the kind of improv they were going for, which is great. But most improv, is going to be like, look, we're not doing those jokes.
And cancer torture is a really ineffective way of getting secrets out of somebody. It's just too slow.
Very slow.
I'm gonna put the microwave in front of you. You're not going to be able to have kids.
In 20 years.
Maybe.
Hate it. I hate it. But I don't have to like it, and that's okay.
Yeah.
Mark, are there any parallels to that kind of philosophy of improvisation that I define it as, when I'm working with groups, that we're setting our sandbox, we're setting our perimeters of play, we're establishing our code together. Is there any parallel? Are there any parallels to the world of philosophy?
Things move more slowly, right? So if I think if we're going to make comparisons between philosophy and improv, it has to be in the philosophy particular speech acts. So not necessarily this philosophy book or the edifice that is philosophy, but like if I'm on a podcast or talking to a student or whatever, and I say something really confused or wrong, then, well, that might be something that gets them thinking about something. You know, we were talking last time, if I say something to you and I'm not even sure what I'm trying to say, well, then I have presented you with some sort of fundamentally ambiguous thing that you then can maybe, you know, some of the best philosophers, the philosophers that got me into reading philosophy are ones that are really hard to figure out what they're trying to say, because it allows you to project something that you find interesting into it. And like, you might read later, like, oh, no, that's not what the guy meant at all. But like, oh, all right, well, I carried away something useful.
That's a great thing with improv. You might start a scene with the line of like, all right, I need your license and registration. And you think you're a cop talking to someone who pulled someone over, right? But if your scene partner then says, sir, he said he needs to see your license and registration, let's go, right? So now your scene partner isn't the person you're talking to, they're your fellow cop, right? And so you got to go, oh, I thought it was this, but now it's this. And that's totally, because you don't get to own anything in improv, you just get to contribute. And then whatever happens, you adapt to it.
And then the third person among us also says, yeah, let's see your license and registration. I'm the helper to the helper. And it turns out that the driver is a mime and so doesn't have to appear in the scene at all.
See, there you go. Like, that was not the scene I was thinking either. And now that's the scene. Mm-hmm. Mary's just like, okay.
Okay.
Yeah, I don't have anything else to add. There's nothing to add there. Yeah.
Fair enough. Well, can I see your license and registration, Mary? I guess that's what I'm trying to ask.
Oh, yeah. I'm so sorry. It's in the glove box. I'm so sorry. I'm a little tired. I had a long night.
It is a bust. That's the way that undercover cops do it now, is they get on podcasts with you. They wait for you to say something indicative of your crime or just your criminal dispositions.
Too funny.
Yes. This is really an intervention. We're all just going to talk about our actual crimes that we've committed in our lives.
I feel like so much of life lately, definitely with me, and I've been talking about it more with people to find out if it's not just me, that life right now requires so much more surrender and grace. Mm. It's like you're looking down two different paths to take, and you're like, I could prove you wrong, tell you how you're wrong, possibly trigger both you and I to more anxiety, or I could acknowledge that we all make mistakes, we are not supposed to be in each other's lives. Thank you so much, I wish you well. So Anyone else out there experiencing that?
Sure.
Mark, what's your face? If your face had words, what words would they be?
I mean, I was just thinking, you know, we're still early in this relationship. So I feel like at any point you could just be like, you know what? That thing that you just said about of cancer torture, this is the last episode. Why are you not posting this? So there are risks. There are risks to failure.
Sure.
So you say the wrong thing, and that's the end of that relationship. You know, that can happen in improv or in philosophy. If I say, you know, I think Hitler's had some good ideas about the feng shui of room arrangement. You didn't hear the end. You already shut off the podcast before.
Well, that's the thing, right? Is like trick words, right? So like earlier your thing was like, well, if someone says rape and I go, oh, rape, a four-letter word in my crossword puzzle. It's like, yeah, great. We're not actually talking about the act, but just the word is enough to send audiences into a phase to where they're not going to pay attention to the rest. I used to do a joke in my stand-up set where I used the word pedophile. There was no pedophilia in the joke whatsoever, but I just used it as to help with a punchline, and a cruise ship audience, like, I got complaints. And I was telling the cruise ship director, I was like, but you know the joke. Like, there's nothing bad in it. He goes, it doesn't matter. Mm-hmm. Doesn't matter if the joke is bad or good. The audience, some audience member's experience was bad. And as the cruise ship company, we have to go with that. And I was like, oh, okay, well, there you go. Consequences.
Hence the surrender and grace. Like, to me, there are two things that are not funny at all. That, and it's a personal thing. Anything related to a stroke, don't like it at all, because my dad had a stroke when he was 45. It has forever changed all of our lives. My mom is currently in remission battling breast cancer. So to me, strokes and cancer are very triggering for me, and I don't find them funny. But that's a personal thing, and you don't know that unless I tell you that. So it requires me to either get mad. I can do that. Sure, I can be mad. That's fun. That's fine. Like, oh, be a big old bitch right now? Sure, that sounds swell. Or I can be like, hey, let it go. They didn't mean any harm. They didn't know. They're not attacking your mother. But if you come for Kathleen, I'll fuck you up. That's all I'm saying.
Don't mess with Kathleen. Everyone knows that.
Don't mess with Kathleen. Kathleen will tear you up herself. I won't even get a chance.
And what is Kathleen's level of graveyard humor about her own condition? Like, is that a thing? Or is she... Most parents are not. Like, they're not in this Gen X and down, everything is potentially funny. And so...
I am a product of my parents and myself, but both of my parents are very silly, funny, highly spiritual people. So we don't joke about it because we don't think it's funny, but she has come to terms on it. You know, we're all in terms on it as much as we can be.
Well, we wish her a speedy recovery. That's...
Of course.
Thank you. Yeah. Yeah, but I mean, we talk, you know, it's brought us so much closer. Like, actually... The day that I quit drinking was the day she got her diagnosis.
Wow.
Because to me, if I'm asking someone that I love to moisturize, hydrate, eat good food, take care of yourself, and get good sleep, if I'm asking someone I love to do things, then I better fucking be sure that I'm doing everything I can before I'm asking someone to make sacrifices to be their healthiest self.
Well said.
Mic dropped. I dropped it.
And you certainly don't want to dare to fail when it comes to, like, the surgery, when it comes to caring for your loved ones in their time of need. For instance, I've been scolded even recently, despite my growth, by my wife for introducing humor in situations where mere reverence is called for. So, for instance, anything to do with her family at all.
Yeah. I love the word choice, too. I also love the differentiation between reverence and respect, because respect implies judgment, but reverence is less judgment and more like, I see you, I hear you, I have received your email kind of energy.
And that's one thing that I think everyone has to figure out, especially people who are silly, silly comedians, is that, like, I don't even remember whose funeral it was, but I was trying to find, like, a funny card, a bereavement card, because I thought, oh, this is, you know, help cheer him up. And my mom was like, you know, I was like a teenager. My mom was like, this isn't the time for jokes. And I was like, oh, because I figured I'd want to laugh. And it's like, maybe I would, but like most or not everyone else would. And so it's like, you got to read the room. And, you know, if you know someone who will laugh at anything, you can joke about anything. But if you know someone's got trigger points or whatever, then you get to know and you're just like, okay, I'm not going to joke right now.
Well, I hereby give anybody permission to do a bit at my funeral. If you think that if you think it's funny, if you fail, you've got only one chance. And it'll be videotaped and it'll be broadcast on the tombstone. So your failure will be show over and over and over again. And like, his life was great, except for this one thing that this guy did at the funeral ruined it for everybody.
So your tombstone is actually going to be digitized and it's going to like show footage of fuck ups.
That should be the future, at least for entertainers. Yeah. It has like a little clip show of their.
That sounds like that is actual hell to a performer. For everyone who's listening, my face is now in my hands.
So you know how like you go to the gas station now and like there's advertisements playing and you're like, I just want to pump my gas. And I could imagine going to a graveyard and it's just like a bunch of screens with things going off. You're like, no, I just want to be quiet.
So even in death, you're still auditioning. That is actual hell. That is 100% hell for me, personally. But Mark, you do it. That sounds great.
I think there should be a regulation so that there has to be a button. It can't be motion activated. You can't be walking through the graveyard and all these stones are like, hey, learn more about me and my life. Like, that's too intrusive. It'll be like those museums where you put the thing on and you push the button and like,
there you go.
This is when Mary was cool.
I died in 1922. Yeah.
I love that voice. Why is it that worth?
Oh, welcome. Welcome to Interactive Cemetery.
Ooh.
In order to engage with the lives of the people.
Marshall, why is the gravestone laughing? It wasn't this. I guess the person recording it screwed it up the first time, and they decided that
I'm
mistake.
I'm crying.
as the narrator should be, frankly, if they're going to narrate my life, I want them to be really upset about it.
Yeah.
It and then the and was to add like that little like gravelly growl to it, and I couldn't handle it. It was too much awesome. I am a mere mortal.
Mark, what you're saying earlier about joking at your funeral, there's a video of Monty Python, I want to say from 20, 30 years ago, where they were all in like reunited, but Graham Chapman had died, and so they had an urn sitting there. And they did this whole bit where they were spilling the ashes and all this stuff. And, you know, they were being extremely irreverent about their friend who they love, who was dead. But, like, that was their way of joking about him, right? That was their way of showing love to Graham Chapman was by, like, you know, Tom, you know, it's like, well, he's bloody dead, you know, and just being, like, real sharp and aggressive with him. And it's like, that's awesome. I think that sounds more like your funeral.
I feel like this is something that I wanted to say earlier, but now it's coming back again, that it's very important to listen with yourselves, to really like listen deeply in order to hear and discern the love language of the person you're engaging with and suspend however you might normally want to speak to them so that you can speak to them in a way that they can hear you.
Yeah.
So that Monty Python thing, that's like a beautiful application. Like, yeah, that's their love language is totally irreverent, like fart jokes and dead parrots. Like, it better be that. That's the language.
Hell yeah.
As opposed to the Jim Henson one, where they like the characters came out, the puppeteers came out, and they sang Not Easy Being Green or whatever. Mm. You know, they had the funny elements, but ultimately for, you know, sentimental purposes, which Muppets, that they're sort of made for that.
No.
they're self-aware, they're ironic, but yet they're still feel good.
Yeah, a good Muppet movie always hits you in the feels.
So we'll have to see when the South Park guys die. Whichever one dies first.
Oh, yeah.
What the other one will and their cohorts do to support that.
Oh, it's going to get ugly. Yeah. Hopefully we have them for a long, long time. I'm a big fan.
All right, so we started out talking about failure. We turned, you know, to talking about failure in careers, So they're basically objective failures. You know, you started out with surgery, failing when you're dealing with a loved one or just any interpersonal relationships. You know, hopefully you have the openness and you have the ground that you can, you know, if you say something wrong, you can go back the next day and show that you've learned from your mistake and that relationship is not forever destroyed. You get at least a few chances to fail, a few chances before the person's like, oh, that's just what you're like. I don't want to be around that. Yeah, what are sort of other areas of objective failure that maybe we should, I mean, it's the overall, what philosophy, you know, which a lot of people take to be stoicism is for, is like, you don't have to get the A, as you were saying, Mary. You can get the B, whatever, you ultimately set your own standards. There's things that happen out there, and then it's what you decide you think about them. And so really, there is no such thing as objective failure. It's only just failure. You know, you set up goals for yourself. Nobody else sets up goals for you, you know, or you don't have, you know, they can offer them, but you don't have to take them. And so there's no way, if you have the proper attitude, that you can actually fail in your life.
You nailed it with the proper attitude. Yeah. In improvisation, to me, failure is either myself or someone else gunning for the joke at the expense of the integrity of the scene and the safety of your scene partner.
Nice.
To me, that's failure.
Yeah. To me, failure is all metrics, right? Like if my metric is to have $1 million and I don't, I've by definition failed, right? And so when I put in my book, I had a lot of struggle throughout improv with what is a good scene versus what's not, because it wasn't always easily defined. So I defined it as this: a good scene in improv or good show is, does everyone on stage feel supported? Is the audience entertained? And if, to me, if those two metrics are met, then it's a good scene. The reason I did it was because I had a teacher or coach once who, we did a show that by my metrics was good, but there were certain things that we didn't do that he wanted us to do. And he was like, well, that show was terrible. And I was like, but the audience loved it, you know? And so you get to make your own metrics for what failure is, whether it's friendships, relationships, your life in general. And I think you're always in charge of what that metric is. So if you're like, I'm not a success until I make $1 billion, that's a tough sell. You can be in charge of that metric and go, well, what if that wasn't my metric anymore? What if it was just to, you know, help people and be happy, or, you know, something like that?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And I feel like it's really challenging. I've been finding this in my personal life lately. Like, no one is checking in on your elective course of improving your life, right? Like, no one is checking in on those metrics for you. You are the one that gets to see, assess, reshape, and implement an alternative plan. So sometimes that pisses me off. I'm like, is no one seeing how hard I'm working and like how like adaptive and kind I am? Sometimes I get really cranky about it because you're the one.
You want someone to give you an A.
Yeah. Oh, fuck. God damn it. God damn it.
I sometimes despair, not so much that good things are not always rewarded, but that it would be more dramatic if true failure wasn't just a silent disappointment, but like,
right?
That there's a gong or something oh man, that if you are, you know, a puffed up prick trying to impress people and failing to impress them, probably you're only going to know because like they don't make subsequent efforts to be your friend. Not because they're usually not going to be rude enough.
Yes, Carl, that's a great point. I want to move us along. You are my two idea kings, you know, co-ruling crown princes of ideas. So we've got this new campaign for the app called Sounds of Failure. I'm going to need you to pitch to me a couple different sounds of failure. What does failure sound like? What do you got? What do you got, Carl?
Oh, I'm only a millionaire. I haven't made $10 million yet. I'm a failure.
Okay, so and then we can do like a short clip that just is like failure. That's good. Yeah. Carl, what do you got?
I think the most obvious time, I think everybody knows that when their parent says, oh, that's so nice, sweetie, that, you know, actually it sucks. Like, they would be more enthusiastic than that, but they're going to say that for whatever piece of crap you create. So Oh, that's so nice, sweetie. You got it. We might have to try a few different actors. Yes, yes. That's pretty good.
I like it.
Yeah.
That's so nice, baby.
You got the classic. Womp, womp,
womp. Yeah, that's a good one. Yeah. Oh, I got a good one. I got a good one. What about fuck?
Nice.
I think we got a good pitch.
Can we give a scenario where this would be really useful to administer? Like, okay, somebody gives a public speech, they're in front of the classroom, and it makes no goddamn sense. Then they want to hear, fuck! Like, is that kind of what you had in mind?
Yeah. So you just, you know, all the kids can have their phones these days. So I'm thinking we can really get the app in a lot of hands. We can really make a lot of money off of this. So they can have it in class, and then they can play different sounds of failure as they like. And that you got to pay for upgrades.
Yeah, and then we can put a slide whistle in there, like a whoo.
That's great.
I mean, how could we, though, keep this from being abused? Because I would think, like, this is a great way of providing feedback to public speakers, teachers even, that, you know, if the teacher is just boring the shit out of everybody, the students should be, whoo. But you could see students just kind of wanting to do that just because to be silly.
Carl. Like,
age verification
Carl,
or something.
Carl. You don't get a corner office by caring about the implications of what we are introducing into society. Do you think I got to where I am caring about people's feelings? Do you?
No.
That's great, Mark. Good job. Great and scene. Perfect. It's perfect.
For anyone confused by the audio, that was Rich's interjection at the end there. That was not me. So point goes to Rich. You had
plenty of good stuff there yourself. So points go to all.
I did feel like we were going to end that scene with one of the fuck, or, you know, one of the things that we had done.
Yeah. That's what's so fun about, when I talk about the sandbox is we've defined our sandbox, right? At the top, I define it as like, it's a pitch meeting for this app for sounds of failure. And then, so we've got that defined and we're like, oh, cool. I know where I'm at. And then we kept adding toys into the sandbox and that repeating game of the different sounds. Then that is an example of success because Rich wasn't like gunning for the joke. He just picked up the Godzilla toy that was in the sandbox and was like, Godzilla.
It's a Godzilla.
And I think we've established that if we do a scene Godzilla. That you think did not work, Mary, that you can say, that was so nice, sweetie.
And
we'll be
hold
a
on,
code.
Let me see if I can get back to it. Hold on.
That was so nice, sweetie.
That was good. That's very good.
Close.
I felt the disappointment.
Oh.
That was so nice, sweetie.
Oh, there we go. All right. I was pulling source material from, I don't know, for anyone who's listening, you've heard me talk about how much I love horror movies. And I rewatched Child's Play the other day. Mm. And when the kid makes her breakfast in bed and it's just like a hot mess, like that is it.
Oh, that's so nice, baby.
That's nice. Good job. You poisoned your mother. Great job.
Is it okay for streaming services to just add when a terrible movie concludes a wah, wah at the
Wouldn't
end?
Wouldn't that be awesome if instead of thumbs up or thumbs down, you can choose like a fuck yeah or like that rocked or like stupid corporate America. Like that would, I would engage with the streaming service feedback if those were my options.
There you go.
I'm a fan of those like Mystery Science Theater riff tracks, those kind of interjection sort of thing. And it does seem like somebody would, I not that I would think it's a good art form or that it would replace the real thing, but I do want to hear somebody try to do that with AI so that any given thing that you launch, you can turn on the feature that some smart alecky AI will start making fun of the film for you.
Ooh, hard pass for me, but enjoy.
Okay, I'm going to offer a note that in, instead of AI,
I know it can be done.
Hire your friends, right? Hire humans instead of artificial intelligence.
I mean, we'll be all freed from that. That's the kind of, you know, when we're freed from the drudge work by the robots, making fun of movies will be like one of the things, not that an AI can't do it, but that we'll get to do just, you know, on a continuous basis.
I was actually talking about this with a friend yesterday, a delivery robot passed us and he went, "Aw, Marco," and like said the name of the robot. So we started talking about the robots and I did the research and like, they can't actually hear you, but I'm always a please and thank you person with any technology. And this might sound like I'm kidding, but I'm being absolutely serious. When the robots take over, I think because I am nice to them, they will keep me as like a fresh content generator, or, you know, to like remind, you know, to help train their generative base.
Wow. See, I'm thinking more M. Night Shyamalan's The Happening. I think the plants are just going to be really pissed off about all the technology and they're going to take over. But Mary also talks to trees, so she's good there too.
Yeah, I had one of my exes said it was like totally serious. We were walking somewhere and he was like, "Oh," he was like, "we're going to be late. I should have left more time because you have to say hi to everything." It's true, though. I do. So I'm good either way, y'all. I don't know.
The first time I took a walk with Mary, we're in Los Angeles, and she stopped at about every single plant and just had a full-on conversation. I was like, all right, here we go.
Yeah. Palm trees need pots, the big old babies. Who's a big grass?
So not just films, but plants. Not an AI generated. Here, I have a different variation off the idea, but like, we just have the option of allowing ourselves to be recorded. If you think you're a smart ass person and you want, you know, just like you might be Instagramming your clever things all day, you have the option of just whenever you see a plant or you're seeing a movie of making, and these will get recorded and put into the database of things that then when future people listen to it, they have the option of turning on the commentary track and whether it's an AI that's selecting or people are, you know, upvoting comments. So then eventually you would have a crowdsourced humorous commentary track to not just movies and TV, but everything that you see.
Wow. That's the way things are going.
I feel like Rich and I are made for that. Yeah. I feel like that's what Rich and I do all of the time. Like, we are constantly, that's our relationship. That's our friendship.
If all those comments you make could be repurposed and shared with, you know, so that your genius will be recognized.
Thank you for the updated pitch. I think that, go ahead, get it in my inbox. Google Doc, please.
Google Doc.
Google Doc, Google Doc.
I give that idea to the world. I just want credit. It is on a Creative Commons license.
Join our Patreon in order to thank us monetarily.
Yes, I think we are grinding to the end. Rich, any concluding sentiments about failure? Was this experience a wild success?
A wild success, as successful as it comes. Yeah, I'll just say that, you know, there's a cute mnemonic device that you might hear a lot of people say. Failure is first attempt in learning, which is cool. I take slight umbrage with the word first because I think that it takes a lot of reps to get to learn anything. So it's not just your first attempt that you can fail. You can fail hundreds of times. I have failed a lot of times at finishing a novel. And I wholeheartedly believe I will finish a novel at some point in my life. But if I think about all the times that I haven't, that's going to weigh me down, right? So it's like you get to own the metrics. You get to decide how many failures you're allowed. It can be allowed infinite as far as I'm concerned.
And death, final attempt at living. No, that's
there you
that's
go. Not,
but it doesn't have an I in there. It's an A.
Failure.
It's close. All right. Wah, wah.
Okay, that's all we need. Guys, that's all we need for the pitch meeting. Clearly, you need to take your lunch because we're out of ideas. You're my two best idea men, and it's empty.
Thank you so much, Rich, for joining us. Thank you, Mary.
Thanks for having me. Really nice meeting you, Mark.
Thanks, listeners.
Oh, it was a blast. Bankrupt.
Bankrupt. Thanks for listening to Philosophy vs. Improv. Get more at philosophyimprov.com. Support the show and get our supporter-exclusive post-game segments at patreon.com/philosophyimprov. This podcast is a member of the Partially Examined Life family of podcasts.